That means is that I'll be going through some calculations on the board, and these are sort of less conceptual and more just work, and therefore I don't want you focusing on trying to transcribe what I'm writing and getting every index accurate. It's better to try and just focus on seeing how these things are done, and also if you want to stop and ask questions about, say, some of the steps, then it enables you to concentrate on the calculation rather than just writing down. Mainly because I'm told I go a bit fast when I do this type of thing, so this is why this handout is in existence. So the purpose of what we're going to try and do, hopefully all today, but if not, we'll finish it up tomorrow morning, is we want to apply what we've seen, this formalism, the mathematics, to a physical system. And the physical system, which is, of course, like the first thing Newton may have applied his gravitational laws to, and that is some isolated object. I've said a star in the handout, but really it's any sort of self-gravitating celestial type of object. So in order to find solutions to general relativity which are not just perturbative but fully non-linear, we usually have to make some simplifying assumptions. And that's in order to make those Einstein equations tractable so that we can solve them. So in the case of a star, if we look at the sun, the obvious thing we see is that it's round. So this leads us to think about spherical symmetry. And then another natural thing to think about, at least to leading order, is that the star is static. So in other words, to leading order, we're just going to say this thing is just sitting there and not actually doing anything. Now we know, of course, nature isn't quite so straightforward, but this is, to a good approximation, what we see, the same way that we approximate our universe as being homogeneous and isotropic. So just like with the Friedman-Robertson-Walker cosmology, we're going to make some physical observations and use these to simplify Einstein's equations. So I don't want to just sort of write down what the metric is and then compute it. I want to actually go through in gory detail how you actually use these statements to simplify the metric so that we can see examples of the usefulness of the killing vectors and how that translates into symmetries of the metric and how that then gives us the form that we write down for ds squared. So static, what static means is that so we know what it means intuitively. How do we translate that into the mathematical language? Well, it means, first of all, it means there's a time-like killing vector. So we've got this notion of time with respect to which the physical system is invariant. But static's a little bit stronger than that. Static, well, there's two ways you could think about it. You could think about it as being time reversal invariant. If it's not changing to the future, it's not changing to the past. So but this is called essentially the technical definition is that this T coordinate is hypersurface orthogonal. So what that means is that your d by dt killing vector is sort of orthogonal to surfaces T equals constant. That's sort of saying the same as, I mean, I think of it physically as time reversal symmetry. But what it means is that you can peel off this coordinate T, and that it's sort of, you start off with a dt squared piece in the metric, and there's no cross terms. So that's more or less what it's saying. You could have a time-like killing vector, but not have things being static. That would be an example of a rotating black hole. So rotating black holes still have time-like killing vectors, but they're not time-reversal invariant. If you go back in time, they spin in the opposite direction. So we want to do the simplest possible example to see these things in action. So what do we mean by spherical symmetry? Well, we know what it means. What it means is that things are round, that if you do rotations, the metric doesn't change. So what that means in the language we've been using . So I'm being a bit vague what I mean by that. I'm about to specify it. It's on the very first page. I better make sure I get the signs right for this. So it means that there is a symmetry group of the metric, which is the SO3 group. And since I told you that killing vectors said that the metric was symmetric, what that means is that we've got an SO3 algebra of killing vectors. So that means that psi I, psi j is epsilon I j k, psi k. So we're used to thinking of angles when we have spherical symmetry. We've got our intuition from polar coordinates. And in polar coordinates, we would write . So those would be our normal polar representation of these killing vectors. And in fact, we can choose coordinates, theta and phi, to label the surfaces which are invariant under this symmetry, in other words, the two spheres. And those will be our killing vectors. So that's allowed us to choose essentially our coordinate system. We've got the T associated with the time-like symmetry. We've got two angles associated with the SO3. And then what remains is going to be R, the coordinate on which everything depends. So we know what our coordinates are now, at least in principle, but we need to know what the components of the metric are. And that's where we use the killing symmetries. So if psi is a killing vector, that means the lead derivative along psi of the metric vanishes . So if I write that out in components, this is what I get. So if I use this coordinate basis, then what I'm going to do is to pick out the killing vectors here, put them in that equation, and see what it tells me. So obviously the easiest killing vector is psi 3, So that's just d by d phi. And that just corresponds to 0, 0, 0, 1 in a coordinate basis. So the derivatives of psi with respect to any coordinate vanish because it's either 0 or 1. And all we're left with is the first piece. So that tells us the metric is independent of phi. So that's already a useful piece of information. Now we're going to use, let's say, psi 1, doesn't really matter which, and we're going to put that in to this equation here. So let's just rewrite. Psi 1. And so in this case, this corresponds to a vector in the components. So now you can see that they're going to be non-zero derivatives of psi. So this killing equation is going to be less, it's going to be non-trivial. So if I just transcribe it for psi 1, I know that d by d phi of the metric vanishes, so the only term that I pick up is this first one, the theta component. So I multiply by psi theta, so that's my theta derivative of the metric components. Then these two terms here are essentially the same, but A and B are swapped. So I'll just focus on one of them. So obviously, if I'm taking a derivative of any of the components of psi, I've got to be taking an angular derivative. So here, if I look at the theta component, which is sine phi, if I differentiate that, I get cos phi, but then that A index, or the mu index, has to be a phi index. And then what's left is g theta nu. So I'm taking here the theta component. Yep. No, I'm not in an orthonormal basis here. In the coordinate basis. That psi 3 is just d by d phi. So in this case, I'm taking the theta component of psi. So that's why the theta's there. And I've differentiated that with respect to phi. People happy with that? That seems to be a little... Yep. So now I'm going to look at the phi component, which has got a bit more to do. So I take g phi mu, and here, if I look at psi phi, it's cot theta cos phi. So when I differentiate cot theta, I get cosec squared theta cos phi. And then that only works if the mu index is a theta. And then I can differentiate the cos phi. So that's taking care of that first term. And then, of course, I've got to add nu and mu interchanged for the last piece. Now, because the metric is independent, these metric components are independent of phi, each of these terms which multiply sine and cosine have to vanish separately. So I might as well pull them together so I can see what I've got. that's the first thing with a sign phi in it. And then the only other one is here. So let's pull those together. And then I'll pull the causes together. So each of these has to vanish separately. So if you see that apart from the first term, all the other terms need one of the indices to be an angle in order that they don't vanish. So if I look at mu and nu being t or r, this tells me that there's no theta dependence. So that tells me there's no angular dependence at all in the T and R components of the metric. So then I look at mixed component. So I'm going to look at, say, mu equals R and nu equals theta. So if I put in here the top bracket, neither of these are phi, so the second term goes, so that tells me that g r theta comma theta is zero. And then if I look at the bottom one, it's going to say, well, let me see, nu is theta, so neither of these terms come in, and the only one that comes in is here, so it's telling me that g phi r is zero. So there's something else, zero. Then if I take mu equals r and nu equals phi, then if I look at the bottom line again, if mu is phi, the only bit that contributes is this, and so I've got g theta r equals zero. So I don't really need to look at the at the top line, because that doesn't give me any new information. So what I've got now is that there's no cross terms between the T and R and the theta and phi. So there's no off diagonal out sort of cross terms in the metric. And the only thing that I haven't yet fixed is the theta and phi part. So then I have to look at this equation here, or pair of equations, for mu and nu equals theta and phi. So if I take both of the indices to be thetas, then I find, not surprisingly, g theta theta comma theta equals zero, which is actually a bit pointless because you could probably always rescale theta, but never mind. And then the second line, if both of these are theta, these terms don't contribute, and so all I end up is the second bracket, and the second bracket tells me that the cross term g phi theta equals zero. So now I've shown that my metric is completely diagonal, just by using the symmetries. And then finally, if I look at the last two possibilities, if I look where mu and nu are equal to phi, well, the top line gives me g phi phi comma theta is equal to 2 cot theta g phi phi. So this is actually telling me that g phi phi is proportional to sine squared theta. On the bottom line, I don't get any further information because I know g phi theta is 0. And then if I look at the cross term, here if mu is theta and nu is phi, top line doesn't give me anything. Second relation tells me that g theta theta, that's the first piece, nu is phi, mu is theta, and then I've got minus cos equals cos x squared theta g phi phi. So what that's telling me is that g phi phi was, I know, was proportional to sine squared theta. Now I know it's g theta theta times sine squared theta. So by using these symmetries, I've boiled myself down to the following metric. So this last bit with the angles in it is usually denoted a d omega. In this case, you put a 2 to indicate that this is the metric on the unit 2 sphere. So in general, it would be a metric. D omega would be a metric on an n sphere. So using the symmetries, we've boiled ourselves down to a much, much simpler looking metric. So that's really what you do in cosmology. It's just, in fact, it's even simpler than this. But it's use the symmetry to give you, to choose coordinates, which gives you something simpler looking. This has still got a gauge degree of freedom in it because I haven't specified what the R coordinate is. I can do a rescaling of R to anything I want, and so in practice you use this to choose a convenient gauge. So you could rescale the R coordinate to any arbitrary function of R, and it wouldn't change that general form. It would simply alter the detail of A, B, and C. So in practice, knowledge, you rarely do a metric from first principles in practice, but what you may come across is a situation where you know the symmetries of the metric, so you've got a pretty good idea how to make a stab at writing it down, but you use the symmetries that you have in order to decide what the, you know, what the most general form is in terms of these functions. So I think as an example of that, I was just trying to think of an example where this might come in. An example of that is actually the Atiyah-Hitchin metric, where the Atiyah-Hitchin metric tells you something about motion of monopoles, say two monopoles. And in that case, by studying the equations of motion, you know something about the symmetries that this space has to have. So you know there's an SO3 symmetry. But the original attempts to find this metric, which were by theoretical physicists, used the knowledge that people had about coordinatizing metrics. And so they knew that there was like an R coordinate on which things depended. It's a Euclidean metric, and three angles. And initially, so in that case, if you just wrote down something which was in R4 and you had three angles, the first thing you might write down would be spherical symmetry. So this would be something dr squared and something d omega 3. But the three sphere has actually two copies of SO3, or strictly speaking SU2, which it's symmetric under, a sort of an SU2 to the right and an SU2 to the left. And so if you write down a round metric, that's got far too much symmetry. So people knew a little, you know, that they could kind of distort this three sphere to break that symmetry. But what people were familiar with was something where they broke one of the SU2s down to a U1. And so that was the initial stab at finding this metric. But they kind of knew it wasn't right because there was too much symmetry in there. There was a U1. And so what Atiyah and Hitchin did was simply come along and write down the, you know, sort of an orthonormal basis, which is what we're about to do to calculate the curvature of this metric, and to write down the most general set of functions with strictly an SO3 symmetry, no extra U1s and nothing else. And that allowed them to find the solution for this particular space that they were looking for. So that's kind of an example where, by keeping an eye on what symmetries are, it can help you choose the right sort of metric, and it makes sure that you haven't accidentally either put too much or maybe, in some cases, too little in. So what I want to do now is to take this metric and actually go ahead and compute the curvature for it. So although I've put it in the notes at this point, I'm going to come back to that gauge choice once we've got the curvature. So in order to calculate curvature, I'm going to use the Cartan formalism. So not only do I think it's good for the soul to actually compute a curvature by hand, I know everybody these days always just buns it on Maple or Mathematica, I think it's also extremely invaluable to developing a feel for what things should look like. So discussing this with Cliff Burgess a couple of days ago, and he said, ah, yes, you know, computers, great way to get the wrong answer fast. Of course, it only gives you the wrong answer because you're asking the wrong question, but there's more than a grain of truth to that statement. And how do you know you're not asking the wrong question? It's by developing intuition. And I'm afraid there's no easy way of developing intuition other than actually just getting your hands dirty and going ahead and doing calculations. So it's true, things can go faster on the computer, but it's also true that by doing it yourself, you learn to spot patterns. And eventually, you don't need to go to the computer, because if your metric's simple enough, you'll actually just write it down straight off because you've had enough experience with it. So the Cartan formalism is where we're going to move away from this coordinate basis. So we're going to go to the orthonormal basis. I'm sorry, your name? I'm terrible with names. But Anton. I'm going to try and get to know people's names, but please beware, I might forget them from now, time to time. So Anton was wanting to put an orthonormal basis in before when he asked me about the question about derivatives for phi. So let's do that now. So we're going to find an orthonormal basis. So what we need to do is we really want this orthonormal basis. That means that we want a GAB to equal eta AB, or in other words, our ds squared, our distance, was eta AB omega A omega B. So this would be our metric G as our second rank tensor. So it's kind of obvious what to do here. It's not really rocket science. We've got A dt gives us this as being omega t squared. B dr tells us the second bit is just omega r squared. I'll try and remember to hat the indices, but so I'm hatting the indices to emphasize that this is an orthonormal basis. And these are forms, so I better underline them. So that's my orthonormal basis. So if you remember Cartan's first structural equation, told us that if I took the exterior derivative of my basis, or an element of my basis, I got information about the connection one forms. Of course, I've got vanishing torsion because I'm in Einstein gravity. So in order to compute the connection, what I need to do is simply to take the exterior derivative of these forms. So d omega t is just a primed dr wedge dt. D omega r is just zero. D omega theta is just c prime dr wedge d theta. And d omega phi is c prime sine theta dr wedge d phi plus c cos theta d theta wedge d phi. So that's just taking the exterior derivative of those four forms. So you're just taking d. If you take d of dt, dr, or anything, you get zero. And so all you're left with is actually taking the derivatives of the functions, pre-multiplying the coordinate one forms. So I want to make a link with this theta AB here, so I have to write it in terms of the omegas. So this is going to be minus A primed over AB, omega T cross omega R. So at this point, now I've split the sign so I can read it straight off. So I'm massaging this into a form where I can simply directly read off these one forms, the connection one forms. Is it obvious what I've done there?
You say again why d omega r is zero?
Zero because, so first of all, when I take d of any of these parts, dt, dr, or whatever, I get zero because it's d squared. But the point is this b is a function of r. So if I took its derivative, I get b prime dr wedge dr. And because the wedge product is anti-symmetric, a form wedge itself is zero.
Okay.
So the theta again, what I'm doing is I'm dividing by the relevant function to go from the coordinate one form to the orthonormal one form. And then I've swapped the order of the wedge product so that, again, I can read straight off from this formula here. For the bottom one, it's essentially the same. And because this is a reasonably straightforward metric, we don't really have to work any harder to find the components of those connection one forms. So here we know d omega t has to equal minus theta t b wedge omega b. The only thing we've got here is a t wedge and r. So we can see that theta t r hat is a primed over ab omega t. We're kind of also using in the back of our mind the information that d omega r is zero there, so that doesn't tell us that an r component here, the one form, is zero. It just tells us that it mustn't, if it's, it must carry the same index there. So remember I said that for an orthonormal basis, these connection components were antisymmetric. Okay? So what that means is that theta t hat r hat is equal to eta tt theta t hat r hat, okay, which is theta t hat r hat, because that's just one. So that's minus theta r hat t hat by the antisymmetry property. And then this is equal to minus eta r hat theta r hat t hat, and that is equal to plus theta r hat t hat. So I know that that is the same. So basically I'm just using this to write down in full detail all the non-zero connection one form components. So I've lowered the t index, it doesn't cost me anything. Swap the ordering gives me a minus sign. Raise an R index gives me a minus sign. So these are just like symmetry properties of that matrix.
It almost seems like you weren't able to read that t hat off the second equation.
Well, I was actually, because what it tells me is that theta R hat B cross omega B, the sum of them all has to be zero. Now, because these omega b's, each different b is a different form, it tells you that individually they all have to be zero, which tells you that this theta r hat b has to be either zero or proportional to omega b. And as you see, this one is proportional to omega t. So you wouldn't have told you what the constant of proportionality was, but you knew that that was the only possibility.
There's enough structure in these equations to actually get the whole thing.
Sorry?
There's always enough structure in the equations.
Yes, there is. I mean, because this is a linearly independent, it's a basis, so it's linearly independent. Although this looks like a single equation, it isn't. It's the number of dimensions you've got. And so although here it's a very straightforward set of equations, and you can literally read it off, here you see, well, that gives me theta r is c prime on cb. If you've got something that's more complicated, where you maybe have a more complicated say, you know, the S3 with Euler angles, you do get a little bit more complicated relations here, but it's still just a set of simultaneous algebraic equations. You're not solving differential equations here, it's algebraic equations. So there is always enough information to find the connection. It's just that it's, in some cases, it's not as straightforward. So if I just go through, by the same argument, I can read off these other ones. And in this case, if I want to take the R theta, swap the R and theta, I get a minus sign because I get one minus sign from lowering theta, second one from swapping the order, third one from raising. And so I've peeled off the R components here, but then the only one that's left is phi theta. So although we've kind of paused to discuss some of the nitty-gritty detail about how we peel these off, etc., etc., you can see that in principle, if you were just doing this yourself, you would simply go, okay, da-da-dee-da-da-dee-da-da-dee-da-dee, if this is that, I peel it, reorder like this, and I read it off. So it's actually a fairly straightforward calculation. Need that lock on top. Okay, so now I want to use Cartan's second equation. So now I'm going to compute the curvature two forms. And it's again by this process of exterior differentiation and, in this case, multiplication of the one forms. So if we just take our time to go through the first one, RTR is therefore going to be d theta TR plus theta TC wedge theta CR. So first of all, the only non-zero form with a t-index is tr. So there's no way that any of these terms can be non-zero, because as soon as I make c equal to r, I've got rr here and that vanishes. So that gives me nothing. And theta tr is just a primed on ab omega t if I replace what the basis one form is, that's just a primed on b dt, and so this is just a primed on b prime dr cross d And once again, I can turn these back into basis forms by dividing by the B for the R and the A for the T. So, that's done one. You can see that, and I have written them in that handout, that at least for the theta R component, it's going to work essentially the same way. So let's just keep going with things where the way of calculating it looks a bit different. So these curvature two forms are antisymmetric, so let's, we've only got to calculate TR, T theta, T phi. So there's no one connection one form with indices T theta. So we know that in this case, it's just the cross term I'm going to get. And since I said that this was only non-zero when you had the R index there, I know I have to take that product. So the first one we read off, and then the second one, then we read off. That tells me what that one is. And again, if I replace theta with phi, I would actually get the same result. So that's given me all the curvature components that have a T index.
Sorry, is this a Ricci tensor or the
Riemann? So I'm computing the Riemann tensor. So now I know all the components of the Riemann that have time component in them.
It's got two indices, but it's also a twofold. So
yeah.
It's actually got more indices hidden.
Yeah, there's a lot hidden. There's a lot going on there. Well, that's the beauty of this, because it's carrying along with it the fact that it's a form and not just individual components. You actually get a lot for free in terms of, you know, for the algebraic manipulation that you're actually doing. So again, the only time something unexpected, if you like, occurs, or not unexpected, but where you've got to do a few more steps, is when you've got some of the angular components. So I said that the our theta R would work in a very similar way to our TR, but let's look at the phi component. So the only thing that happens that's slightly different here is that I know that phi theta is non-zero. So I do have both an exterior derivative term as well as a cross term here. So if I look at the theta phi r, which is here, c primed over cb omega phi, and replace what omega phi is, then here, when I differentiate, I get two terms. I've got the r derivative, and then I've got the theta derivative. And I've got a sign error. Okay, so what you see now is if I try and make those into forms, or I change my omega phi into c sine theta d phi, these two terms actually cancel because they've got the same prefactor, same function as a prefactor, but one is d theta cross d phi, the other is d phi cross d theta. So those two terms cancel, and what I'm left with is as very similar to the TR component. So the only thing that I haven't as yet calculated is the r theta phi component, but basically with that, so in this case, I have to make this an R-index, and I'm taking here d of cos theta d phi. So theta phi r is c prime on cd omega phi, and theta r theta is minus c prime over cb omega theta. And so this is just minus sine theta d theta cross d phi. So I simply get the final non-zero curvature 2 form. So as I say, there's a little bit more detail in the handout, or at least you've got all the steps in there. But what I've just done here is computed the ones we've peeled off, which we'll finish off tomorrow. I've just computed the full Riemann curvature of that metric. So it's, and I've been going through it a little more slowly because it's been on the board. We've been discussing, you know, what happens when you swap the order of indices, etc., etc. But if you have ever tried to by hand compute a Riemann tensor using the expression with the Levi-Civita symbols and the derivatives and all that lot, then you'll probably appreciate that this is a heck of a lot faster and also less fraught with the capacity for making mistakes, in the sense that when you're contracting over the indices, it's often quite easy to forget something. So, although I haven't quite finished, we'll finish it off tomorrow and then look at what the solution, you know, the simple Schwarzschild solution is. This is clearly a lot more straightforward and much, much faster as a means of computing curvature. So you can see that when you're presented with a more complicated metric, this gives you a much more tractable way of finding curvature. Okay, so we'll stop there for today. Any questions? It's not really been so much concept, it's been more a calculation. But I think it's important for you to see how, you know, to actually see a work in progress, a calculation being done. Okay?
How can you tell that if you subtract the indices to get the Ricci tensor, that it's going to be zero outside of the matrices?
Well, I haven't got there yet. We haven't even written down the Riemann components yet. So I haven't got there yet. At the moment, we've just computed the curvature. Once we compute the curvature, we then know what the Ricci tensor is, and then we'll look at Einstein's equation to see what that tells us about the solution. We haven't even written down a differential equation yet. So
there's not a simple way to see the Ricci tensor from these two points.
Not really, because when you take the Ricci tensor, you're going to be pulling together all the different components.
Yeah. So we're going to see the relation between these things and the Riemann tensor, and then use our known definition of the Ricci tensor.
Yeah. No, we have to peel off first what the Riemann is. Yeah.